I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rick Santorum campaigns in Texas today, hoping to capitalize on his three-state sweep in yesterday's caucuses in Colorado and Minnesota and that non-binding primary Missouri. If the victories were a blow to frontrunner Mitt Romney, they were symbolic because no delegates were awarded. So where are we on the GOP delegate count? And with Mitt Romney in such a strong lead, what does it matter going forward? Alexander Burns is national political reporter for Politico. Alex, you write today that Santorum did deal an embarrassing setback to Mitt Romney's campaign, but Romney has almost twice as many delegates. So why was this embarrassing?
The fact of the matter is, the biggest challenge for Romney since the beginning of his campaign has been convincing conservatives that they can trust him and showing the country that he's going to have a unified Republican Party behind him. He campaigned in two of the three states. He spent money, and they rejected him for Rick Santorum. So this really does give Santorum in particular, but all the conservative candidates in this race, one more shot at making the argument to their donors and to voters that they deserve real consideration as potential nominees.
Well, that one of the other conservative candidates, Newt Gingrich, who's in Ohio today, managed only a third-place finish in Colorado yesterday. Ron Paul took second in Minnesota. But might Rick Santorum have benefited yesterday from a sort of a culture war moment? We have that Susan B. Komen Foundation funding of Planned Parenthood, President Obama's mandate that religious universities and hospitals make contraceptions available to their employees in healthcare policies, and then the court decision in California yesterday overturning that state's ban on same-sex marriage. It's going to the Supreme Court. You know, might Santorum have benefited from those issues? And, you know, those issues, who knows how long they're going to last?
Well, I think he'll certainly benefit from those issues going forward. It's hard to know exactly what was driving folks to the polls last night and yesterday because networks, the Associated Press, did not do exit polling. But, you know, clearly a state like Minnesota is a state where the Republican base is heavily socially conservative. Those are folks who probably do identify with Santorum. And these cultural issues have been in Santorum's wheelhouse for his entire political career. And they've consistently been some of Mitt Romney's greatest liabilities. I'm not saying that I think that the terms of this race in the big picture have necessarily been transformed. I still think the economy is front and center, and that helps Mitt Romney. But if you're a candidate like Rick Santorum, who has been sort of pigeonholed for a while as the Christian conservative guy, you know, the terms have shifted just enough that that's maybe not a liability anymore.
And yet, Rick Santorum may be thinking just what you were thinking, which is that, you know, at bottom, the issues are the economy and jobs, because he downplayed the cultural issues on Fox News today and said, you know, he's been talking about jobs and the economy. So maybe he wants to avoid being pigeonholed as the religious conservative candidate going forward. Because talk a little bit about going forward. You know, right now, Romney has 107 delegates, Santorum 45, Newt Gingrich 32, Ron Paul just 9. Now, Ron Paul in particular has been saying his goal is to get enough of the delegates to have a fight or at least have a presence at the convention. But what has to happen going forward for that to happen?
I think of all the candidates, I think Ron Paul has had a particularly difficult last couple of weeks. His campaign did kind of bring the political press along with the idea that, look, he might not be on a path to be the Republican nominee, but he was on a path to have a really serious presence, and because his supporters are so fired up, that he would do well in some of these low turnout caucus states. The best Ron Paul has done is second place, and he's only done that in one state. So I think that we're at the stage of this race where we need to start wondering, you know, is Ron Paul really a more sort of central figure in the party than he was 4 years ago?
Well, and we know that some of the days coming up are delegate rich. March 6th, Super Tuesday, you have 10 states holding either primaries or caucuses, more than 430 delegates at stake, and many of those areas voting are conservative. But what do you think is the math here? Can Santorum really overcome Romney in the delegate race, or is there another factor? Can he get just enough delegates to maybe have a fight at the convention?
What Santorum supporters will say is that they believe that if he scores a couple big wins against Romney in some of these larger states, that even if he still trails in the delegate count, it would be another setback to Romney that would lead the party to say, look, you know, maybe we need to keep this contest going. But the scale of this race is about to get a lot bigger. And that all plays to Romney's really very considerable financial advantage.
Because he has more money to campaign in all those areas.
He has more money. He has a national profile already built in. He has surrogate campaigners in all these states in a way that Rick Santorum just doesn't.
And yet, as we follow this race, you know, we also keep in mind anything can happen. Alexander Burns, national political reporter for Politico. Alex, thanks.
Thank you.
Here are the headlines. 11 charged in massive billion-dollar pension fraud scandal at Long Island Railroad. Or a conservative Rhode Island think tank claims that thousands of public workers there are making more in retirement than while working. Headlines like those drive a perception that public pensions are way over the top, and coupled with a shortfall estimated at up to $1 trillion in public retirement funds, states are looking for ways to make changes in the traditional defined benefit systems in which states manage accounts and workers receive set payouts on retirement. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to offer new employees the option of a 401k-type program, plans that workers invest in and manage, and payout depends on the markets. Republican legislators in Congress are drafting legislation to address pension plans. We don't know what that will be, but Senator Orrin Hatch has hinted that states should just scrap their current defined benefit plans altogether. But New York State Democratic Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli says, bad idea. He is calling for a national review of pensions, but he says most state plans are sustainable, there are a lot of myths, and defined benefit plans are cheaper in the long run. Comptroller DiNapoli joins us from his office in Albany. Welcome.
Robin, nice to be with you.
You have what you say are myths about these defined plans, so let's just get right to it. First of all, the myth that states are underfunded. It sure feels that way in a lot of states like Illinois. They say they're, I think, something like only 43% funded.
And that's certainly an extreme case, and there are other states that are also in trouble. And very often what you find is that these are states that in the good times were not meeting their pension fund obligations. You find many more states that have been willing to pay what they needed to pay to keep the funds in strong shape. Certainly for the New York Fund, we're about 90% funded right now. That certainly is a healthy level of funded status. And as the markets continue to recover, we will get back towards 100%. Certainly we have no problem today in meeting the benefits, no problem with liquidity or how we do our payouts. You know, our fund's been around for 90 years. I believe our fund is sustainable not only for today, but for the future as well.
So you're saying it's not the system, it's that states didn't fulfill their obligation and put into their funds.
Well, very often you found when states had other budget issues or other fiscal challenges that an easy way out was to skip or reduce the payment that you should put into your pension fund as a way to help with other budget issues. That's too often what happened. Or the actuarial recommendations were ignored, again, as a way to provide some short-term budget relief. And, you know, think about it. We really have been going through a historically challenging time with what happened, you know, with the recession and the near collapse of the financial markets. So those states that were not well-funded going into that downturn, of course, they're going to have an even greater problem today. So I think one of the messages is when you have your actuarial recommendations and you know what your payments are, don't skip on them, because in the long run, when you come to a downturn like we're going through now, it's really going to leave you exposed. So you have states now, because they don't have the money, you know, to pay their benefits, they're really having to make some very extreme changes. Even here in New York 2 years ago, we started a new pension tier, which reduced benefits. As you pointed out, the governor's proposed some additional changes. But I do think the essential point is that a defined benefit plan is a much smarter, a more cost-effective way to provide retirement security for retired workers.
But, you know, some of the states that maybe dipped into their pension funds would say, and state officials have been saying, that they overpromised, that they had to give too much to the defined benefit plans, and that they're too expensive. One of your claims, which is sort of eyebrow-raising, is you think that's a myth, and you say, in fact, defined benefit plans cost 46% less than individual 401k-style savings accounts.
When you take a pool of capital, you professionally manage it and invest it, it's a much more efficient way to provide the benefit than if you say to folks, put in your money, we'll match it with some money. People tend to not have the investment expertise, so when you start adding in the fees...
You say people investing in their own 401ks pay higher fees, for instance, so you're factoring that in.
Yeah, and then, you know, some people will then go to financial planners to get advice on where to put their money if they're in a, you know, a 401k style defined contribution plan. It's going to cost more money, you know, from that perspective. Also, if you're an individual, you're going to base your decisions on how to invest your money based on where you're at, age-wise, how close are you to retirement, and you may not be able to maximize the opportunities that are in the marketplace. When you're part of a defined benefit plan and money's being managed for a whole pool of people that constantly has people at all ends of the age spectrum and retirement spectrum, you can take advantage of market opportunities. And the other piece, of course, is that We all think we're going to live forever, especially when we read the studies, everybody's living longer. So as an individual, you will target your investment strategy on an assumption you're going to live to your 90s. The reality is that not everybody's going to live that long, and money through a defined benefit plan that's being managed can base it on the reality of the mortality of the membership. All of that results in higher investment return, a more efficient way to deploy the capital, less administrative costs as well. So it's more efficient, and at the end of it, you get a more secure benefit as well.
Okay, well, let's take a couple things here. As far as the affordability, you say you have some stats to back up your sense that at least for the state, you know, how much the state puts into defined benefits, it's not that big a percentage of state spending. What are those stats?
You know, it's around 2.7% of the state operating funds. So certainly it's higher than it's been. But again, we have to keep in mind, much of the spike that we're going through right now has to do with the market loss in 08 and 09. So I think we need to keep that perspective in mind, and we need to look at the benefits of having people with a secure retirement. You know, in New York, close to 80% of our retirees stay in New York State. They don't move to Florida or other states that may be less expensive, because that pension makes a difference between them staying here, paying their bills, paying their taxes, being part of the community. You know, so there's that opportunity to recycle into our economy statewide, and in our regional economies, those pension dollars get to stay in New York. That's part of fueling local economies as well.
And the dollars you put at an estimated $6.5 billion in spending, $9.5 billion in economic activity, $1.3 billion in property taxes. So you speak of these pension funds as if it's recycling money, you know, putting it back into the economy.
I think it's unfair to just look at it in terms of the cost. How much are the government employers, you know, paying? What is the return that we're getting back? We know that part of why our economy is still struggling is many people are afraid to spend because they're very uncertain about the future. Here we have a group of older New Yorkers, older Americans as well in other states, who have that security of having that pension. That gives them more confidence to not be afraid to be spending. And I think that's something to keep in mind. The fact that in the private sector there's been a move away from defined benefit, it doesn't mean that that's good. And that's why I do think there needs to be a larger national discussion. I'd like to see presidential level commission to really look at, first of all, with the public systems, what are the ones that are in trouble? What can we do to help them? The ones that aren't in trouble, what do we need to do? What are the best practices to keep them in strong shape? And then there really needs to be that larger discussion. What do we do about all those in the private sector that no longer have this kind of retirement security? And is there anything that the public plans can do to help in that area as well? Can we provide opportunities for small businesses, for individuals to be a part of these plans or to have some of their retirement money managed by plans that are successful? It's an interesting idea. It's worth study. But I think the issue of retirement security is one that we really need to have a national discussion about, not just leave it to each state kind of fighting over this current challenge of increases in rates that everybody's faced with.
New York Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, who's been making the case for defined benefit pensions, traditional pensions managed by states with workers receiving a set amount of money in retirement. He says these are cheaper in the long run than the defined contribution plans like 401k programs, where the employee sets aside some money, which an employer may add to, but the employee manages it and retirement depends on what the market will bear. And Tom, critics of the defined plans, the traditional plans, say that these are taxpayer dollars. But we just heard workers are being asked more and more to put money in. But then there are the stories of the public workers making more in retirement than they make in salary. Address that.
I think it's rare that you have somebody that would make more upon retirement. You certainly had some extreme cases where there's been an abuse or there's been padding in the final years of working, and where, you know, if you have, let's say, a significant amount of overtime, and then you end up with a pension that may be higher than what your base salary would have been. But, you know, in New York, we've already taken some steps to control that. In the new tier, there's now a cap on how much overtime can be applied to your final average salary, and part of the governor's proposal is to reduce that even further. So, you know, I think there are ways to deal with that. I think we have to, again, face the reality of the numbers. For the New York system that I administer, less than 0.5% of the pension payouts are six figures or higher, 100,000 or more. 76% of the pensions are 30,000 or less. the average pension, excluding police and fire, which are higher, but the average pension for the 94% of the workforce is about $19,150. You know, those are core middle-class working folks, the backbone of our communities, and we need to keep their interests in mind and not just make decisions looking at the extreme cases where perhaps there's been an abuse.
What about fairness, though? I mean, if you mentioned how private employment has gone to these 401ks, and there are people who say those workers had to take risks, public workers should as well. You know, you have your critics. The New York Post editorialized that the New York State employee unions supported you when you ran for office and that you are now supporting them by so defending defined benefit plans. And they go on to ask, why shouldn't state employees be on the same kind of plan most people in the workplace have and take the same kinds of risks?
First of all, public employees are different than private sector, and these kinds of pensions have been part of the workplace arrangement for a long period of time, and that's often why people have chosen to be in public service. And let's keep in mind, the kind of pensions that we're talking about, you have to work usually decades, you know, 20, 25, 30 years to get, you know, a pension of some value or some significance. And I believe strongly in the defined benefit plan. I believe that before I was a controller, and certainly as a controller, and I think, you know, in a democratic society, if people that agree with me want to support me, there's nothing wrong with that. That was my belief, you know, before I ran for this office. And that's because if you don't have people with retirement security, and we saw that in this recent downturn. You think of all the people that had the 401ks that were about to retire and the value got wiped out as part of the recession and the market collapse. And they're still working. They haven't been able to retire. Think of those who had retired, but they only had a 401k. How many stories were there of seniors in their 70s and 80s having to go back to work for minimum wage jobs just to find the money to be able to put food on the table or to continue to pay their rent? Ultimately, it becomes a societal obligation. If we have a growing class of people that do not have retirement security and are not able to provide for themselves, where are they going to go ultimately? I would suggest a large percentage of them are going to come back to the government for assistance. That ultimately becomes a taxpayer expense as well. Why not avoid some of those costs by keeping this level of retirement security? And I would say what we shouldn't do is a race to the bottom. If there are too many workers in the private sector that don't have retirement security anymore, the answer is not to jeopardize that for those that have it. 401ks, those style savings accounts, were meant to be a supplement and part of a picture of retirement security, including a pension. They were really never intended initially to substitute, you know, for a pension.
Well, the Motley Fool, which is that financial services company, they agree with you on defined benefit pensions. They say they make money available for investing, but also they guarantee an income, as you said, that retirees will then spend into the economy. But Governor Cuomo isn't suggesting getting rid of them. He's just saying, you know, make a choice so that new workers, new public workers can choose between the 401ks and the defined benefit.
You know, the fact that it's a choice doesn't make it a good choice. My fear is you're going to have many people opting into a defined contribution plan, assuming that they're only going to be working for a couple of years for the state. You know, I know how I was in my 20s. Whoever thought you'd work in any one place for any period of time. And once you opt in, you know, that's it. That's your choice. You're locked into it. I really think that any way you look at it, having that defined benefit plan and a strong one is still a smarter choice for people.
But then what happens? Because as the New York Daily News writes, even you warned a couple months ago that New York taxpayers will have to put 19% of public payroll costs into pensions, a 50% increase in 2 years. And you're just now meeting the, as we say, the bulge of retirement age workers. How do you handle that?
Yeah, and I think their numbers might be referring to the city system, not to our state one. Again, we view this as a short-term issue and a short-term problem. Certainly, we've been trying to work with local governments, suggest ways that they can control their pension costs in terms of how they handle issues of overtime and work schedules. But you have to look at the history and the trends. We've had ups and downs on the contribution rates historically. This is not brand new. I think the challenge for today is that it was such a severe market loss in 08 and 09. We've had a significant increase in the rates at a time that state government aid to local governments has been cut back. Federal aid is, you know, was obviously not what everybody would like. So it's all these combination of pressures. But I don't think we should use that as a reason to say we're going to destroy what's been a very strong part of the fabric in New York State, and that's to have a well-funded and, I think, for our state's economy, very helpful defined benefit plan that's given retirement security to many, many New York families. And I think it's something for us to not be so quick to throw by the wayside right now.
New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli saying, as you just did, sort of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Keep defined pension programs for public workers. Comptroller DiNapoli, thanks so much.
Nice to talk with you.
Western Union, the telegraph and global payment company, is bringing back its singing telegram.
Happy birthday to you, baby. Happy birthday to you.
That's the rapper K-Non delivering greetings, not at your door like back in the day, but by email. In 2006, Western Union ended its singing telegram service to focus on its money transfer business. Now they're back, featuring artists like K-Non and Timbaland. But can they deliver it the way Pat Villalpando did? Pat used to deliver singing telegrams for Western Union back in the 50s. He joins us from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Pat, is this bringing back memories?
Well, I wished I'd have been that good as that last one I heard. That was pretty good.
Well, but tell us, so we understand was your first job. You were a messenger for Western Union. What
right.
happened? How did it start?
I was a junior in high school, and I saw the opening, and I applied for it, and I got it, and I remained with them 17 years. But as a messenger boy, the toughest thing I ever had to do was two singing telegrams that I did, and it scared me to death.
Well, let's explain why, because you had to literally go knock on someone's door, ask for the recipient, and then give us an example of what you might do.
Well, it's just like you described. I went to the door. My knees were shaking more than my knock, and I knocked, and they came in. I started singing, and I was scared to death, and they all appeared to really appreciate it and even kind of applauded it, but it was scary. But later on, when I left there, I stayed with the company, and I went to larger offices. Then we'd do a lot of it by phone, and we'd get two or three people together and do it.
Well, then Western Union stopped offering the singing telegram, as we heard, and the vacuum was filled by these other companies that sent out employees, maybe wearing costumes. They dance, they deliver balloons. You know, we know that you can send a stripper to someone's home, so it kind of grew. And now we have this, online singing telegram where you can actually, we're going to post some on our website, but you can actually download your face and sing along to Snoop Dogg and Timbaland. What do you think of that?
I think it's a terrific idea, and I think the retirees and the present employees will be tickled to death to hear it, because I think that's a great idea.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask. Can you just give us a little of your dulcet tones?
Happy birthday, dear Robin. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Robin.
Oh, yeah.
Happy birthday to you.
Pat Villalpando, thank you so much.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing. I bet a lot of people didn't know, but in 1926, Western Union was the largest company in the world.
Wow.
And that's a fact. And I know they're not nearly as big today, but I'm really glad to hear about this new singing telegram.
Pat, thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
And we mentioned the rapper K-Non. He's now delivering singing telegrams, but apparently not candidates.
Give me freedom, give me fire, give me reason, take me higher.
This is K-Non's waving flag. Mitt Romney was using it at campaign events until K-Non asked him to stop. Just one of many musicians putting the kibosh on candidate soundtracks. Newt Gingrich was using Survivor's Eye of the Tiger. Frankie Sullivan, a former band member, told the New York Times, a song can lose value if it becomes entwined in the public's mind with a politician. He sued. Gingrich stopped. Mitt Romney got a new song from Kid Rock.
But tell him if I don't survive, I was born free. I was born free.
The Las Vegas Sun reports that another popular song with Republicans is Toby Keith's American Ride. But as the Sun points out, Keith is a longtime Democrat, and while the song conjures up quintessential images of flag and country, the lyrics mention global warming and foreclosures. The Gingrich campaign cuts those verses out.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride.
Ron Paul has used the Darth Vader theme from Star Wars. Rick Santorum, he was brought on stage last night with triumphant orchestral music. He may be onto something. He won all three states in play yesterday. Back in a bit, here and now. Gotta love this American ride. Doctors are now saying that social media, especially Facebook, is fueling that Tourette's-like disorder that's affecting teens in the tiny town of Leroy, New York. You may have seen the teens. They have odd tics and twitches and some verbal tics. It all began in the fall with a few girls and now has spread to about 17 girls, one teenaged boy, and a 36-year-old woman. Dr. David Lichter has treated several of the sufferers. He's familiar with the others. He says this may be a psychological condition. He's a professor of neurology at the University of Buffalo's School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. So, Dr. Lichter, how does social media fuel this?
Well, to understand that, you really have to understand the basis for the spread of this disorder in the past, which is psychogenic in nature.
We've heard that word. What does that mean, psychogenic?
Well, it means that the syndrome is based in the psyche so that the underlying symptoms are generated, we believe, subconsciously from internal stress, conflict, or anxiety, and then are manifest as physical symptoms without the patient's conscious awareness of that.
Okay, so that's something a lot of people interpret as hysteria, mass hysteria. Is that what
yes.
you're saying?
Mass hysteria is another name for mass psychogenic illness. Whether you call it mass hysteria or mass psychogenic illness, by far and away the majority of individuals affected are women or young women, girls, adolescents, as opposed to males in that same age group. Women may be internalized stress more than males. Perhaps they're more sensitive to individuals in their own environment. In the cases that have been described as mass psychogenic illness before, typically you have a very small number of individuals who may have a true biologically based disorder. It may come down with physical symptoms or perhaps neurological symptoms, which have a true biological basis. And then other people in the immediate environment start to develop the same kind of behaviors, but subconsciously.
So that's why we had cases of school kids and teachers who'd have nausea and vomiting, an outbreak of uncontrolled laughing that lasted months in Chinese factory workers. These were largely women. You're saying that maybe the first couple of people might have had something that was biological, but then the rest almost catch it psychologically?
Yes, that's exactly right. But the spread here is not through a virus or bacterium or other infectious agent. The spread is through line of sight, and that's where the social networking comes in. So in the past, you've had the spread occurring from person to person who've been in a very enclosed, segregated environment like schools or institutions. And nowadays, I think we have the capability of the same kind of spread, again, through direct line of sight through video. I do believe that the same thing happens with YouTube and Facebook. We know that a number of these individuals have uploaded video tapes of themselves, and I think the potential exists. Just as in those segregated institutions, if you happen to be vulnerable in some way, if you have stresses and conflicts and anxieties of your own, and you see people behaving in a certain way or developing certain physical symptoms, you may be prone to adopt that same physical symptom or behavior. And this, I think there's a potential for this to occur if you receive that visual input over the web or over TV in the same manner as if this person was in your own classroom.
So some of these young girls who posted videos of themselves showing them, you know, having these tics and these, you know, one girl saying, hey, 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 and her arm flinging up, you're saying that other people just seeing that might have literally picked it up themselves. You know the resistance to this. First of all, this idea that women might be more vulnerable to something that's called mass hysteria. Many women see that as insulting. They see that as a weakness in women. But you used another word, which was sensitivity.
Yes, I think so. There have been a number of explanations for why women may be more at risk of this kind of behavior. Some people feel that women internalize stress more. Another thing is that it's been shown that women are more sensitive to things that are going on in their environment than men are. It's women who do seem to be more sensitive, perhaps empathize physically or emotionally more, with people who seem to be suffering in their immediate environment.
Well, it's fascinating because it seems as if you're saying, I remember years ago when the word meme, M-E-M-E, first came about, this idea that you could have an idea online that could almost be like a virus. You're saying that people can pick up a psychological disorder in the same way. But a couple questions. Yes. First of all, there have been cases, there was one in Britain where teenagers were diagnosed with the same thing, conversion disorder, and it turned out their symptoms were linked to pesticide poisoning from a chemical on cucumbers that they were eating at lunch. Now, you know, a lot of parents in upstate New York feel that there may be the same kind of thing there. There was a toxic spill in 1970. How can you be sure that it's not something else?
You're quite right. There was a toxic spill which took place. It was over 40 years ago. That toxic plume, as it's being called, actually does seem to be moving slowly away from the school and not closer to the school. The contents that were spilled, there's one in particular called TCE, has been looked at by the New York State Department of Health. There's been no previous cases where exposure to this particular chemical has resulted in any kind of neurological disorder, particularly no movement disorder or tick-like disorder. But the other thing is you have to ask yourself why it is that only young girls in this particular school have come down with this very circumscribed group of symptoms, and also not other people living in the immediate environment.
We again say there is one boy, but you make the point that there's so many girls. What about people who doubt whether it's real, that they might be faking it?
All I can say is that these individuals, the vast majority, have been evaluated by doctors from the Dent Neurological Institute in the first place, and then subsequently by others who have been brought in to provide second opinions. And where the children have been carefully evaluated by skilled professionals, to date, what we know is that all those who have undergone such careful evaluation have all been diagnosed with conversion disorder, which is quite different from other kinds of psychologically based syndromes where the patient does have conscious awareness and is feigning their symptoms. All of these individuals who have been evaluated in the Leroy outbreak have been found to have very serious underlying psychological conflict, stresses, and anxieties in their lives.
Or just the stress of the darn social networking. We've been talking about that in the office. I mean, that can be very stressful.
Absolutely. You know, I think that can provide an additional stress if you're continually being exposed to this day after day. I think the spotlight needs to be turned off these children and their families, and they need to be given the time to heal, because this, I think, just perpetuates underlying anxiety.
Well, when you see some of the pictures of these girls online, you know, you can't imagine that somebody would make this up. These tics seem really unbearable.
Yes.
But are they treatable?
Well, they are treatable, but you don't treat them with tic-suppressing medications. You provide psychological support, counseling, psychotherapy, and if there are underlying anxiety disorders, you can treat that with medications as well. But the important thing is to make sure that the diagnosis is well understood by the whole family, not just the individual, but the parents.
Dr. David Lichter, who's treating several of the sufferers of this disorder in upstate New York. He's a professor of neurology at the University of Buffalo School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. Dr. Lichter, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
It's coming. Maybe you've seen the trailer.
Welcome, welcome. The time has come to select one courageous young man and woman for the honor of representing District 12 in the 74th Annual Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games is due in theaters next month. The book, the first in a trilogy, has spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, becoming a must-read for young adults who plowed through Harry Potter and then Twilight. And The Hunger Games is much darker than both. It's set in the distant future, a dystopia, which I explained to my niece was sort of the opposite of a utopia. In place of North America, a futuristic totalitarian capital ruling over 12 impoverished, almost medieval districts. To prevent rebellion, an annual celebration, the Reaping, in which a young man and a young woman are chosen by lottery from each district to fight to the death while the country watches on television. It's Survivor meets Lord of the Flies. Really dark stuff. Children kill each other. So why are so many people hooked on The Hunger Games? Tanya Cochran is an English professor at Union College. She and fellow professor Jill Morstad made The Hunger Games required reading for their English 100 reading and writing course. And she joins us from NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. Tanya, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So why Hunger Games?
why not Hunger Games?
Yeah.
It's time. It's time for Katniss.
And Katniss, we should say, is the protagonist. The book is narrated by this 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen, who lives in District 12 with her mother and 12-year-old sister Prim. They're both eligible for the reaping, and when Prim is chosen, Katniss takes her place. But, you know, what did you see in the writing? What in particular did you see in the literature that you thought would make it good for a course?
It was last summer, early in the summer, actually, that my colleague at Nebraska Wesleyan, Megan Winchell, told me that she had just finished reading this trilogy, partly because her son, who was, I believe, 12 at the time, maybe 11, he had read it. And as a result of those two reading it, Megan convinced me to read it. And even as I was reading, I was taking notes. I'm always thinking about how can I tap into what's happening in popular culture, what's relevant, especially to young people. How can I bring that into the classroom and use that? So some of the topics that came up for me as I was reading, I immediately thought of race issues. I thought of gender issues, of political issues, you know, the role of government, issues related to ethics and spectacle, and of course, class issues. It just immediately was an extremely rich text that I knew I could use in a classroom to raise issues that were relevant to students' lives, but also to the lives that they will have when they leave college, when they become citizens
well,
in the world.
It's funny you mention that because when different news stories come along, some of the presidential candidate debates, different sporting events, I find myself thinking, oh, that's so Hunger Games. You know, it does.
Yes.
It feels like it taps into so much that's going on in the culture. But parts of it I found difficult to read. Parts of it made me angry. What are your students saying to you about it?
Some of them were very resistant to reading, partly because of the violence. And we talked openly about violence, how it is used in other texts. I teach on a faith-based campus, so there were discussions about the violence in the Bible compared to violence in the Hunger Games. There were many conversations with those students about how old is old enough to read such things. And the reality of violence, not just through media, you know, fictive media, but what about the realities of violence that we see through the news or that we see through documentary film about Iraq, Afghanistan, etc.? You know, how do we deal with violence that's in our face? We can't escape it.
Well, and the author, Suzanne Collins, who's very private and has not done a lot of interviews, in what she has said, she's made it very clear that this, for her, is about war. I guess she was flipping through the channels when she got the idea. She went from a reality television competition to Iraq war footage. And she has said, you know, look, if people don't want to think about children and war, we send children to war all the time, you know, young people. And so here it is in your face. What else did your students say about that or about the role of the media? Because Suzanne Collins has also been critical of the media. So did they have comments about the media and war?
Not so much about the media itself, like news coverage, but they definitely picked up on the connections between the filming of the games and reality television. Some reactions fell along gender lines. There were many female students who were, of course, very interested in the love aspect of the story. The male students in the class fell along lines of being very interested in the combat and strategy and survival and how that those ideas in the Hunger Games are linked to video games. So it was very interesting to watch as many of these young men realize that the games that they play regularly are in many ways as violent or in some cases more violent than the reading of the Hunger Games. Yet they had this reaction to the Hunger Games almost as if they were fathers saying that this isn't appropriate for young people. They should not be reading this. And I said, well, you know, what about what you read, what you play, what you watch on television? How is that different? And so it really made a lot of them stop and think about the choices that they were making and the forms of entertainment that they were exposing themselves to with no thought. So if nothing else, I really feel like each student has a better grasp on their own decision-making process.
You know, and when we think about, you know, and I came to it the same way you did. My 14-year-old niece read it, then my sister read it, and she told me about it, and I read it. And I was thinking that when we read Lord of the Flies, you kind of understood that a group of kids would not be put on an island so that they would end up, you know, practically cannibalizing each other.
Yeah.
But now people are put on islands. I mean, yes. You know, in their world, you're reading The Hunger Games in the context of things like this sort of happening.
Absolutely. One student in particular explored the connection between The Hunger Games and child soldiers. And we hear quite a bit about Uganda and the children who are taken from their homes into the army there and often committing these heinous acts of violence under the pressure of their own survival. So the book, while it certainly operates on a mythological level or plane, it also operates on a very literal plane for some children around the world. So it raises consciousness, even if it is fiction, even if it is dystopic and it's set in a future that we have not reached. It is both real and symbolic at the same time.
That's Tanya Cochran, Associate Professor of English at Union College in Lincoln, Nebraska, talking about Suzanne Collins' book, The Hunger Games. The movie is coming to theaters, and Tanya used the book in her classes. Tanya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.